Welcome to the motherfucking Soulcast. Today's guest, Sage motherfucking Francis. Straight out of Providence, Rhode Island. Strange Famous Records. Sage and I, we've made a bunch of music together. Been on a few tours together. And this interview is me just digging in and pestering him on his political views. I'm just really trying to pull out what this motherfucker's really about, because he's a true iconoclast. He's a true rebel. Someone who doesn't toe the party line. He doesn't do what anybody says he's supposed to do. He does what the fuck he wants. And on top of all that, you know, he uses his platform to put on other people, whether it's Jared Paul or B. Dolan or the Meter Maids or the countless dozens of artists whose careers are, have been strengthened a lot by Sage. And I count myself as one of those people. When I went independent from Anticon, Sage really had my back and really, you know, opened up his shit for me. And he's a fucking good dude. But, you know, we're going to talk about music. We're going to talk about life, fucking emotional shit like depression and journalism. And this is just a fucking awesome interview. And when this interview was over, I was just really reflecting off of how fucking authentic and real this motherfucker is. And how that in itself is very revolutionary in the period that we're living through right now. And it wouldn't be an interview with another musician if we didn't talk about, you know, technology and culture and how it's shifting and how things have changed over the years, because that's fascinating and fucked up and depressing. Anyway, check out this interview. Go over to Strange Famous Records, pick up some records, and when Sage is in your town, show up. This podcast is made possible by generous contributions to motherfuckers on Patreon. Huge shout out to Robert Boyle and Eric Ireland and all the other people who are making this podcast possible. And to those who don't know, we're about to launch a 24/7 anarchist radio network and podcast network called Channel Zero. Shout out to all the people participating in that. It's Crime Think, Submedia, It's Going Down, Final Straw, Witch Side, Resonance Audio Distro, myself. And that's going to be a 24/7 anarchist radio network online. Get the app. It's dropping in July. In the meantime, check out this awesome interview with Sage. Yeah. Sage Francis, what up, dude?
Soul. Young soul in the house. What it be?
What it do, partner? What's going on out there in New England right now? In your house, in your kitchen.
Rain hit. Yeah, I mean, well, I just moved to the living room, and it's nice outside. The rain stopped. It's not freezing anymore. I can open up windows, so it's actually I'm feeling very, very good. It's like my appreciation of life has risen by a few percentage points.
Yeah, winter is tough out there. I don't know how y'all do it.
It is. Yeah, I know. You sold out and went to a nicer place, but I'm not going to hold it against you.
Well, you know, I got to do what I got to do, man. No one out there really ever liked my shit, so I had to go somewhere, you know?
That's what makes the edges sharper. They don't like my shit either.
how's poker going, man?
It's tough, man. New England's tough in general, really. New England is tough for hip-hop and for especially the kind of stuff we do. And the older we get, it's like we don't have our college friends able to come out to shows anymore because everyone is, you know, they're wifed up or they got kids, they got careers. And so we have to continually try to win over more younger fans who can come out. And it's like it's not a large majority of young fans who, rally around this kind of hip hop, but I'm down with the struggle. I'm down to fight for that.
Yeah, man, that's our that's the cross we have nailed ourselves to. So we better be down to fight for it. Shit, man.
Yeah, it hasn't left me with much time to play poker, so that's kind of sad. But
oh, really?
I'll get back in it. Yeah, I haven't played poker. Well, you know what? On Christmas I did. I went to Reno, and I spent Christmas in Reno in a casino.
That's awesome.
It was really depressing, and I lost a lot of money.
How do you always get booked in Reno, man? It seems like every time I look at your shit, you're always like, oh, I'm playing Reno. It's like, how the fuck? How do you have so many fans in Reno?
Once a year, or maybe once every year and a half, I play Reno or Tahoe. I've always had a strong following out there. It may have stemmed from the hardcore scene is real strong in Reno, and I had a lot of hardcore fans, and they're showgoers, you know, so they come out and support, and they continue to, I think, make their way to shows even in midlife during a crisis.
Well, shit, there's nothing else to do out there. No offense to people who live in Reno, but
that's grimy. I mean, it's grimy. I love Reno. I really like. I'm into those kind of cities that they got their own flavor, and it just feels like its own place. You know, like I definitely dig Reno. Tahoe is like an hour away, and you can only play one or the other. So it's usually like I'm flip flopping between the two. But Reno is the soul. Like that's really got the grimy, dirty ass soul.
And I've had good food in Reno too, surprisingly. I mean, I shouldn't be surprised, but I guess anywhere on the West Coast is just better than most places.
Yeah, and I've also gotten kicked in the balls in Reno by a girl. It's a girl. Like, I'm waiting for the next time I play Reno, because actually I played Tahoe this last time, but I was, you know, during Christmas, I was in Reno for poker things. But, there's a drug problem in Reno. There's, you know, they definitely hit the hard stuff, and there was this guy tweaking during my show, and he kept touching me during my performance. And I asked him kindly a few times to fucking step off. And then eventually it turned into a bit of a scuffle, and I told him to get the fuck out of the show. And all his friends that came with him were pissed off, and this girl came up and kicked me in the balls.
Oh, man.
She nicked me. It wasn't like a straight-on hit, but she tried. And I did have a flash of red, you know, in my eyes, and like, something bad's going to happen right now. And then, yeah. So I don't know what's going to happen next time I go back to Reno, but that's the fun about it, you know?
Right. Freaking, living on the edges, man.
Hell yeah.
When I haven't been kicked in the balls in like 20 years, man.
You're going soft. That's how you're able to have a kid. See, I still can avoid the children.
Yeah, well, that's something else, man. It's like 3 weeks. Like, I'm just I'm remembering what sleep was like. That's for sure. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, it's just cool. Well, let me let's talk about your new album. Your last album, Copper Gone. You decided not to put on Epitaph, but you put it out on your own label. And on top of that, you toured all by yourself. Like, you did like a fucking 5-month tour, just pretty much driving by yourself. Which is like a huge shift from how you've been doing shit the decade before. Can you talk about the decision to self-release your new album and touring like that?
Yeah. Okay. Well, ever since Epitaph did 3 albums for me, but it was only the A Healthy Distrust, which was the first record in 2005, where I felt like Epitaph's inclusion in the whole thing beared any great results. And since then, it had always been like I felt like I was carrying a major part of the burden for a record release. And every single time, the two following albums, it felt like I didn't really need another label to be the like middle entity between what I was trying to achieve and what I'm able to do. So, but I was tied into a contract for 3 albums, and I saw that through. And then by the time it came to do Copper Gone, there was no doubt in my mind I was just going to release it on Strange Famous Records. We had already been releasing a lot of projects, official projects, through the years. And the scariest part about that was we had just left our distribution company, who I was with since 99. That's Revolver. And Revolver had just – like a lot of companies in the music industry started to fall off, or their interest in indie rap kind of just went away, and you could sense it. You could tell that they really weren't going to bat for us on any level, and they kind of were just like, okay, you got your fans, let's just, you know, do the easy route and whatever, not expend much energy on this. And I really started to take offense to that. So I bounced. We went with another distribution company, which proved to be a very wise move, even though it was a huge overhaul and it was very risky. But in the end, it panned out perfectly. There was a lot of changes during that time. But whatever the case, I did tour, and it hit the Billboard Top 100. Just through Strange Famous Records and our in-house team. Like, that was a very big moment for me. It's like, I would say, one of my career highlights, where I was real proud of what we were able to achieve considering the uphill battle, especially this late in my career, and not playing any of the cheap tricks I see a lot of MCs in our general realm pulling in order to get views or go viral. It's like, you know, I just stuck to the bare brass of what I think makes my music unique. so yeah, I was proud of that. And I toured with a team at, you know, I did do the van tour, which is the first time I had toured in 4 years since the Life album came out. So I put a team together. We squatted up. We toured the whole country. I think we did like 41, 42 shows. Then I ended up touring in Europe with my partner at the time, who was handling projections. And that's when I ran into you and DJ Payne One. We did a few shows in France, and I'm not sure if there was any other shows, but
a Swiss show too.
Oh, was there? Oh, yeah, that's right. There
Burn.
Was. Yeah, Burn. Yeah, it was cool. But that was hefty touring. That was a lot of shows, and I felt like I needed to do that because I had been home for so long before that tour. But then as I was touring, I didn't want to go back home and restart the process again. So I decided to just keep touring as long as the shows were coming in. Like, I never try to force anything really. Like, if I'm not wanted in any areas, I'm not trying to like wedge myself into it. I just, you know, I put it out there that I'm willing to play any shows anywhere. If a promoter wants to reach out, or if a venue wants to reach out, I'm easy to contact. I'm easy to work with. And that's why I decided to do this one man tour. Like, man, it ended up being 1 year was 88 shows, and then the following year was 75 shows, and it was me just in my car driving from place to place, and it was exhausting, but I was in this routine where I knew what I had to do every day in order to maintain enough health and energy and wits about me to execute this properly and you know, get done what needed to get done. And I also love the idea that I can play pretty much in any territory. It would boil down to, like, I would play, like, people would be like, why the hell are you playing, you know, East Bumblefuck, wherever? And I'm like, because they wanted a show, and they, you know, made a good offer, and I went there and played it. That's how I'm going to do it for the next couple years. And now, there's been a drastic change since then, because now I'm home. I've only played one show this year, which is insane. Like, that's just like, now I'm home. I'm making sense of my home life again. I'm fixing up my studio. We got big plans for next year. We got big plans for the second half of this year. I'm doing a lot of stuff with B. Dolan, and we're working on the Epic Beard Men project. Nice. But it's been very important, I think, for me to... For Strange Famous Records and for my career and for my personal life, for me to actually be stationary for several months, which is not normal.
Right. Do you have like a routine? Are you like working out and
yeah, pretty much. It's the same thing every day. I mean, I wake up, I change the kitty litter, eat an orange, and you know, I do check emails and Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, and lay out plans with certain people about what needs to get done for which project, and getting photos done, or I'm trying to edit together some video stuff. And every day it's just work from the moment I wake up until I fall asleep. And in the meantime, I think my moments of zen come in while I organized my record room, which had been looked like a hoarder had been living in there for the past 15 years, and it's taken several months for me to organize all the records and digitize the stuff that I wanted to be able to access on my devices if I want to. And that's been really, really meditative, because the ritual of just sitting there and listening to music and editing together waves and shit like that, it slows you down, and it makes you focus on the very the simple things that we base our lives around as musicians. Is that me or you with these like bouncy sounds?
I'm a bouncy motherfucker, man. I don't hear any bouncing though, so it must be me. Is that it?
No, I think it's like the Skype boing, 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 boing.
Yeah. Is that it? No, I don't know.
No, it's internal in the system.
Well, thanks for fucking breaking it up. Now I have to edit this, man. Way to go.
Well, that's what I was just talking about.
It's funny because it's like you talk about being awake all day and working from till you go to sleep. And it wasn't until I had a baby that I realized that I was a workaholic too. And like, I thought I was like, I lived this life of leisure, but I'm, it's like I'm fucking always doing something. And it's like, I feel like I'm never like, I'm not working, 'cause I'm not like going 9 to 5 and all this shit. But it's like this, our work is never done. It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's all types of work. It's not, this is something when people ask me like, how often do you write? 'Cause that's a major part of what I do is how I write and what I write about. But the truth is, I hardly ever write. The writing process is not in the actual act of writing. It's collecting ideas, thoughts, philosophies, experiences. And then finally, when the pen goes to page, you can try to make sense of that as best as possible. But I'm not I know there's all different types of writers, and some people need to write every day, but I write seldom. Like, I'm not the type of person who writes more than I couldn't even say. I write like one or a couple bars every few days, maybe, and then I go back and look at them and say, yeah, I don't know. Or I can build upon them when need be. I guess it depends on the production that's available to me at the time. But you're always working. If you're an artist, you can't take a vacation from that either. Vacations to me are just like, I stress out if I don't have access to all the things that I'm used to being able to access. And I know that's bad. I mean, it's probably not good for my ulcers or anything like that, but it does kind of, like, I can't relax really if I'm away from Wi-Fi for too long, and I can't see if there's an emergency I need to tend to.
I just, there's a Guy Debord quote where it's like, tourism is just the business of going from one destitute place to another. And you know, that shit makes sense to me. It's like the idea of just like, just, oh, I'm going to go stay in a sterile hotel room on a beach and just sit here for 7 days. Like, that doesn't sound fun at all. Like, I like camping because at least you're like having to like collect woods and,
yeah,
and shit like that. You know, it's like, there's like active things that you do that, and maybe it's because it feels like work or something. I don't know.
Well, you got to busy yourself somehow. You're I mean, you're a manic person. You need, you're kind of like, you know, you got to, I don't know, there's an urgency about you that I can't really see you just sitting in one place and not needing to fidget around and touch things and move stuff around.
Yeah, it sucks. My wife's always trying to get me to meditate and I'll sit down, but man, fuck this shit. Fuck this shit. Because, like, do you meditate?
No, I mean, not actively, not in any traditional manner.
I wish I could, but...
I have. I'm not in a yoga, but I mean, I grew up in martial arts, and that was a big part of our, you know, the beginning and end of every routine. And I saw value in it. And there are times where when I'm traveling, because we do a lot of flying, you know, and I really on flights is when I kind of zone out and there's nothing I can do. I can't get up and walk around. I don't have my devices on me all the time when I'm flying and, or even a book, and I'll just, those are my moments. I mean, the universe has presented that opportunity with, it's like, hey, now this is the time where you defrag the mental, son.
Defrag the mental. Yeah. That's great. Well, let's rewind it a little bit. So I was just thinking about, like, for me, like, Lil B in 2009, when he started making these like video YouTube shit. Like, I know you think you're not like a big fan of all that stuff, but for me, like, seeing like those sort of immediate interventions, were really influential for me. That's when I started doing all this mixtape stuff. But then I was thinking about you in Makeshift Patriot and how you were like way ahead of the curve on that shit. And I remember in, you know, right after 9/11, you know, you'd just graduated from college like 2 years before that with a journalism degree. And, so I feel like you had some unique sensibility about messaging and shit around that time.
Yeah, I think I did. I think what really stuck with me in my studies was the ethics of journalism, which are totally missing in most of what people view in the media today. When I came out of college, I was just thinking about this yesterday because it was like, I wish I was back in class and challenging the professor about sensationalism and being like, do you want us to be journalists or do you want us to get jobs? You know, like,
right.
What if I was to tell you in 10 years time, everything on TV is hard copy, everything on the news is tabloid oriented. You know, it's like, all you're training us, you're teaching us the ethics of journalism, but really we're all hoping to get jobs, and none of, you know, like, all of us would just have to break our own spirit in order to get a job in a couple years time. Not that that was an issue for me. I studied journalism because I was kind of skating my way through college in order to access the radio station. So I wasn't, you know, it was easy enough for me to write and come up with stories. It was like, I didn't really intend on pursuing journalism as a career, but it is interesting to see how, in retrospect, how quickly things changed, and how 9/11 and how I processed it with Makeshift Patriot and why I felt the need to do that as soon as I did. It's almost as if it wasn't just me, but I think there were a few of us who could almost predict how it was all going to be used against us as citizens and against the world. As soon as it happened, it was like, there was the shock doctrine, you know, where you say, all right, everyone's stunned now, and then this is how we're going to be taken advantage of by the people who pretend to be our protectors and leaders.
Right. And you put that song out instantly, you know, and I think that is what, you know, you were way ahead of the curve on that, you know?
Thanks to Napster. You know, Napster was pretty new at the time. And or I guess it was not brand new. Was it kind of on its way out in 2001?
I don't know. Back then, I don't think we realized how awesome Napster was. You know, it's kind of like, yeah. I kind of like may pretend it didn't exist or something.
Yeah, but I didn't really have any great distribution, and I knew I wanted it to be heard by as many people as possible. So it was like, throw it up on Napster for free. Hope it catches on. And it did. And we were lucky with Napster too, because we were independent artists, and there weren't that many independent hip hop artists in that time. And we had our stuff on Napster. So when people would search, you know, indie rap or whatever, underground rap is what they would search. And then my name would come up, or your name, and, you know, Atmosphere. And that's really how a lot of people became aware of our music. So people are like, it's different in 2017. I don't like when people make the comparison about what pirating does for artists these days, because they're like, oh, I wouldn't even know about you, you know, if it wasn't for Napster. And it's just a different era. It's different rules. People go by different methods of accessing music and supporting artists. Like, back then, people still were accustomed to paying for music, and they wanted to pay for music. They saw the value in it. They saw, you know, whenever they had the opportunity to get a CD or vinyl, they would grab it and they would pay for it. And I remember our shows back then, people would come to the merch booth and just hand over cash for nothing, just saying, hey, I downloaded this, this, and this. I want you to have, you know, I want to pay you for it. It's like, how often is that happening now?
Yeah. Oh, hey, I heard your shit on Spotify. You know, here's another 3 cents. You know, I'm going to chuck some pennies at you on stage, you know? Oh, man. Yeah, I've never even thought about the comparison between Spotify and Napster.
Yeah, now with the streaming world, everything's going to streaming. So, you know, within a few years, it's like people aren't even going to be really – they're not even going to be downloading music on iTunes or anything like that. They're simply going to be streaming. There's always going to be a faction of fans who want the physical. There always will be. It will be a small percentage of fans, but they will always exist. However, I'm talking about the majority of music listeners casually who listen to music and become accustomed to it being free, or just paying for a service that allows them access to whatever music they want to listen to at all times. And I don't know what's going to happen in order for us to get our proper due, but we're going to have to scurry. We are scurrying to figure out how to stay afloat and pay bills with the music that we spend our life and a majority of our time putting together. And as a person who runs a record label, that is a constant worry of mine. Not to keep labels relevant, but really to make sure artists I care about and work with are able to see proper compensation for their time, effort, and talent.
Right. Yeah, and that's one of the things that breaks my heart about running a small boutique record label that I haven't honestly put a hell of a lot of effort into, but it's just like, I remember back in the day, you'd put out a record from someone and it could like change the course of their life dramatically instantly. Whereas now it's like, oh, basically this is just a stamp and, you know, it'll help you get to the next level, but you're going to have to do a shit ton of fucking bullshit if you really want to make it happen. And and it's just, it's demoralizing, man.
Yeah. What was nice about how it used to be in the good old days was it took a fair amount of effort. You're like, because if someone came out with a 12 inch, like, that's what I really looked up to, how you were able to finagle all this shit from Portland, Maine when it first started out. I was like, when I learned that someone from Portland, Maine was doing hip hop, they're, you know, rapping over beats and putting it on vinyl, it fucking blew my mind, because it just showed that extra steps were being taken because you took it that seriously and you were that interested in really making this proper and doing it right. And it took a lot of initiative. It took effort, and those things are now scrapped. Like, for people to be viewed as official, it takes like just a fraction of the effort in order to put music out these days, which is why the market's totally flooded and why, you know, in order to anyone can record on a fucking computer and upload it to TuneCore and get it up on every digital service in the world, you know, so you automatically have the same distribution as Jay-Z, whoever you are, you know. So the game is totally changed, and the gatekeepers are what I guess become important more than a record label, because a record label acted as that thing, that entity that could figure out all the intricate parts of what it takes to make a record and release it to the world. Right. And it's just, you know, obviously they act as a bank too, you know, where they are funding this project and then taking money on profits in return. But now it is totally different game. So it's the internet gatekeepers, it's the media gatekeepers that have I guess more authority than the labels do.
See, I don't know. I think I've been betting that the shift would go the other way, in that, you know, the blogs are irrelevant now. 90% of, like, you know, radio shows, like all those like old filters that people would find and discover music through, a lot of that stuff is gone now. So I feel like the relevance of labels is, if they can survive, is only going to increase over the next decade, because otherwise, how are people going to discover music that is, you know, 20 degrees away from the sound that they like?
Yeah, that's what I'm referencing when I say gatekeepers, because I think labels will turn into gatekeepers, filters, and trust, you know, like the places that people trust for a filter of the music that they'll enjoy. But that's the same way it used to be, where, like, back in the day, if a certain record came out on Def Jam, you'd be like, I know that this is going to have a certain amount of quality that I'm used to from Def Jam. But that's gone now. But, you know, that's what labels should be in, or will be in the future, where people are like, how come there's a billion songs out there? How am I going to find stuff that I like? And then they find a couple tastemakers, gatekeepers, and they're like, okay, they filter through a lot of stuff. They help develop the careers of artists that I find interesting, unique, intriguing, and, you know, I will let that be my source of music for this part of what I like. I'm guessing that's how it'll work. Day to day things change in this industry. So I want to continue to put out the quality of music that our fans expect from us and stick to our, you know, our own integrity and our own ethos. And I think through the years you win that respect and loyalty from the fan base. You know, some come, some go, but it's pretty consistent.
Yeah, this last interview I did, I haven't put it out yet, but the guy was talking about how we live in the information age, you know, yet all information is free, and like the work like that goes into producing that, like people just expect that. So how can we say that capitalism works when everything in our society is twisted upside down, and the things we valued the most is actually given no value? You know, it's crazy.
I don't know. I don't have any answers for that. I'm always of the belief that capitalism, any belief system and any system is bad when it's unchecked. So there's always going to be some balance to how things go. And but, you know, if you strip everything away, if you take away capitalism and replace it with something else, I'm sure you'll have some songs about it.
Yes, absolutely. Well, all right. Speaking of checking capitalism, you know, again, like thinking back to 2005, I remember at that time I was living in exile in Spain, and I was really demoralized with what was going on with Anticon and like the direction things were going. And then you and your crew, you know, you were doing really well, and you're like, fuck it, I'm going to put my money where my mouth is. And you put up a bunch of money to start nomore.org. And can you talk about that project and those times and and kind of what went into that?
Yeah. Well, after George Bush's reelection, I was with Bea Dolan, and we were devastated, like deflated, because, you know, we were, again, I think seeing how everything was trending, this was an important moment in American history and world history. And we were like, well, what is important? What, how can we make change outside of just getting people to go out and vote? Because that always felt like bottom of the barrel, you know, civic duty shit. And we were like, obviously, making people aware of how their money is spent, who they give their money to, how those companies spend their money, what laws they are influencing and changing, to what degree. So it's a lot of information, and that's a lot of stuff to for the normal working person to try to figure out on their own. So our goal was to make this as simple of a process as possible, create a database where they could search any company's name and get basically the rap sheet on that company, who owns it, what companies they own, what their history of workers' rights are like, and leave it up to the consumer whether you want to support that company or not, and what the options are, and vote with your wallet. That basically is what it all boiled down to. So that took a lot of work, and that was, I mean, B. Dolan disappeared into a cave for over a year, compiling tons of information, working with web developers. My biggest contribution to that project, there was two big contributions. One was the funding. It did take a lot of money. And we also raised funds from supporters. And I'm not sure if we ever got any grants. I know there was a couple grant writers who were down with the team, but I don't think anything ever came of that. But
I think you guys got like $1,000 once at like some green conference. I remember B. Dolan talking
about that. Yeah, like, right,
like,
right.
Like nothing, you know.
So beyond that, the only thing I thought I could contribute that was useful was promotion and make people aware that it exists. Obviously, you know, like it's not worth anything if people don't know about it. So we made a big deal about it. We did a full tour called nomore.org, one of my biggest national tours ever. And I put the logo on all of my records and talked about it in every interview and made sure that, you know, these were Epitaph albums too. So this was reaching out, to people who were outside of the general indie hip hop community. It was far reaching. And I was hoping, and B was hoping, that this would eventually self-perpetuate and become its own movement where more people came in to help organize and help maintain. And truth of the matter is that didn't happen. As the years wore on, the website and the upkeep of it just presented more and more obstacles. And we suffered a lot of attacks on the website, and make of it what you will, but there was companies who were not happy with us and what we were doing. And I wasn't in any position to deal with that. This was not my job. I was full force in my music career and running a record label, and that those two things in themselves are two big careers. Like, that take a lot of time and energy and focus. So I kind of lost track of how that was supposed to all be taken care of. B, I know, was on dealing with several people in different companies. And long story short, by the time, I guess last year, it became very clear. It's just like the site kept going down. We weren't getting volunteers to help out. And we said, okay, well, if the general public doesn't want to rally together to keep this up, then why are we fighting that fight for everybody? You know, maybe there's just a better way, and we have to figure that out. And the only way we could figure that out was with proper funding. So it was kind of a make or break. He said, you know, let's do a Kickstarter or a GoFundMe, one of those. And if we can reach this certain dollar amount, that means it's worth us getting a staff together and having a paid staff who we can trust and rely on to make this website as relevant and reliable as possible. And he put together the video, we put together the campaign, and then when all was said and done, it just did, the general public did not show the support that was necessary for it to exist. So B made all the data that we had collected through the years available for free to the public to do what they wish with it. And hopefully someone will pick up the reins and do something that is helpful for the general public and consumer.
Well, you know, man, no energy is wasted or destroyed. So I'm sure whatever y'all learned from that will go on, you know, we'll find life and wherever you're going, you know?
So. Yeah. I'm not bummed about it. I kind of was like, c'est la vie. It just was like, we know we did what we could. And I think it was useful during a time where it was available to the public. I think a lot of people got good use out of it, but I'm not trying to force a square peg into a circle hole.
That's right.
If you know, something else will come about and maybe we'll find a better opportunity to use the knowledge we gained on this for another project. But for now, let's focus on what we need to do to get by and hopefully help the public in general, however we can.
Yeah, I mean, I just remember when I saw that, when I was on that tour, I was around that energy, and I was like, man, what's the point of fucking rapping about all this shit and giving a fuck if we can't put our, you know, we can't match our words with deeds like that, you know? And I don't know, that was a huge part of the shifts I made in my career and like pulling out of Anacon, and, you know, I was like, man, if we can't fucking do something like this, you know, how is it Sage and B and like a couple people can make this shit happen and all of us, you know, I don't know, whatever. It was,
because it's tough. It's really tough. It depends on how your mind works. It depends on what gives you energy and strength in
right.
your day-to-day life. And not everyone is there. You know, it's like these things can come and go as well. It depends on where you are at in your life and how you are financially and what kind of family situation you have, what your audience is like. And, but it's nothing. I'm kind of the belief that don't burn yourself out on any one thing. You know, because it will cause fatigue. If all we cared about was nomore.org, if all we cared about was activism, if all we cared about was rap, if, you know, like we got to mix up the pot from time to time. Just stay in good spirits as often as possible, and just know overall your goal is to make things better somehow. Whether that's making people laugh, whether that is educating them, whether that is, you know, funding, you know, someone's fucking field trip. It's just I suffered from fatigue, you know, like from being exposed to too much of one thing and then realizing, man, life is just too complicated and you need to mix it up and you have to experience balance in all sorts of ways. So I'm every day living and learning and trying not to beat oneself up over what could have been done better or, you know, how you were fucked over. It's just, that can't be the way.
Totally, man. Totally. Well, you know, that's so funny because that was like my next question. You know, when I would go hang out with y'all and you were like super steeped in activist culture back then. And, you know, but these days, you know, you've spread out your interests and you just like when I see your face, you just seem way healthier just all around. And so I guess part of me wonders, like, was it like, did the toxic nature of like activist pissing contests, like, did that play a role in you kind of like distancing yourself from like quote unquote like radical culture, or was it just more of like a personal decision to, you know, spread out?
Yeah, I guess it was never a conscious, because it wasn't a quick break or anything. It was sort of me slowly recognizing patterns within every social group. It wasn't just activists, but it was like if it was battle rappers or if it was slam poets or if it was it's like if you stick around one certain group of people long enough, you start to recognize, wow, most people are pieces of shit. Like most people are really shitty and they're doing this for the wrong reason. It feels wrong and they're very cliquey and they're like policing each other and they got all these rules that they expect everyone else to abide by. And it is a big turnoff. You have a lyric. This is your lyric, right? Where if you have a cop in your mind, you're not free. Is that you?
Yeah.
I fucking love that line, man. And that line sticks with me because it's not just about cops. It's about so many parts of life. If you've got a cop in your mind, you're not free. And every time I recognize a cop in my mind, I'm like, man, I got to get rid of that motherfucker. Whether it's in relation to, I don't know, actual police or relationship or activism or anything really. It's just like you have to be able to recognize that thing to truly fight for your own freedom. I don't know if I'll ever get rid of the cop, but activists. Some of them are wonderful and they do great things. And I think they go into it with a good heart. I think some people become corrupted when they identify, like their whole identity is based around one thing or, you know, one goal. And it's by any means necessary to achieve that and be viewed as that. I think egos play a big part in that. And it's not just activism, like I was saying, it's everything. I don't know if I was ever, I mean, I wouldn't go out and lead rallies and shit like that, but I still support people's fight, obviously. And I love that there are people who spend a lot of time and energy making sure that this spirit never goes away. And because that allows for the bigger protests to happen when they do, and for someone to have some sense of what type of organization it takes for these to be successful protests, rallies, or dare I say riots.
we could only pray. I mean, that's right on. That's right on.
There was also, I mean, you're familiar with Bob Dylan and his earlier work where he was kind of championed as, you know, the people's poet and fighting for civil rights. And he had these wonderful songs that people would sing at protests. And then when it turned out, he also, like, cause I think about that a lot. Cause I was always wondering what he was talking about when he would talk about the freaks and why he wouldn't show up at these things anymore. And he wouldn't be the mouthpiece for these movements and how so many people turned on him because of that within those, you know, those folk circles, thinking that was supposed to be his only purpose and that was his calling. And like, I look at that and like, yeah, you know, I kind of understand why he ended up shunning all of that and getting those people out of his life, because these people act like leeches at a certain point and they continue to see how they can use you for their own gains. And that's Bob Dylan. You know, I even had that song, Hey Bobby, which was in, you know, calling out to him, like, where the fuck are you, dude? Like, but he was, to me, represented a lot of people I used to look up to for inspiration to do things I wanted to do. And now that I think back on it, I think it's kind of funny because people could probably make the same kind of song about me and I'll be like, fuck you, freak.
You know what's so funny about the Bob Dylan? First of all, I've been revisiting Bob Dylan a lot lately just because the poetry in it is just so fucking good.
Yeah.
Just the way he writes in like these like vague yet concise lines. When I was shopping my shit to Epitaph, Andy, you know, at the time, the guy who was like, I shoved my shit to, he's like, you know, man, your shit just, it sounds too much like Sage, man. And I'll tell you, like, you know, there are people in this world who are the Bob Dylans, and there are the people of this world who are the Pete Seegers, man. And you just need to get used to being Pete Seeger, because, you know.
I can't believe he said that.
And that's not a bad thing to be. And I was like, I just started crying, actually. I was like, fuck you. You know?
It's not. The truth is it's not. Pete, shout out to Pete Seeger. At least you weren't a Donovan, but... he sent me an MP3. Like, I haven't talked to Andy in 2 years. He just the other day, he sent me an MP3 of him rapping in 1988, and you're going to fucking love it.
Oh, man. Great. Yeah, send it to me. I'll send it to him, like, man, you ain't no Chuck D. You're just going to have to get used to being Mac Miller.
Oh, man. He was my dude, though. He did like go to bat for me pretty hard in a company that could give a flying fuck about hip hop.
Yeah. Yeah. That was huge for you. That was great.
Also Anticon stepped in and fucked with a lot of things too, where I think the business folks at old Anticon were not happy about me signing Epitaph and Epitaph looking at other artists that we work with. And they put the kibosh on the whole thing after I signed to them.
Life.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? Often, like, when the story of you and Anticon gets told, I feel like 6'2", really, he's the one who really, you know, reached out to you and made that shit happen more than anyone else. And I know he, you know, I don't know. I've gotten to see him in the last few years, and he seems like he's doing really well in Montreal, so...
Yeah, good. I'd love to be able to get a show in Montreal these days. Those French-speaking fucks can't, like, hook it up anymore. Last time I was there, it was, like, a shooting on campus. But 6'2 is, 6'2 is the dude. He's, like, it's true. We drove up to Nova Scotia, did that project with him. But that was after I had met you, and we did that I'm Afraid song, which turned out to be totally scrapped. And but... all of that was such a whirlwind of, like, who's doing what, where the fuck are they going? Like, I couldn't really make, like, heads or tails of it, but I was really excited to be in contact with folks who were pushing, like, several different boundaries in what I had, like, based my life around. You know, the hip hop shit, maybe I was just, like, full on East Coast rap. Pretty much like straight up 100% East Coast rap until you guys, all the stuff that you exposed me to is, I think, instrumental in me developing different styles. And it also helped to be part of the whole spoken word movement, which I think is what the one unique thing I was able to contribute to your circles at the time. So, man, that was a really interesting era.
Yeah, it was. All right. Here's a question. Do you remember when we were driving to Canada and we saw that moose?
Yes, I talk about it all the time.
Did that moose charge us?
Yes, it did.
Okay, I was just wondering if that was revisionist history or not, because I always say, like, I got rushed by a moose in northern Maine, and, like, people don't believe me. And, like,
we got charged. We were on a dirt road. We were on the border of Canada. A fucking huge-ass moose was in the middle of the road, and you stopped the car, and we're staring at it. And you decided to slowly drive by it. And as we drove by the moose, we're just gawking at the fucking thing because it's massive. Like, it's a magical beast, right? And then just as we got by, we look behind us, and this thing pivots and charges the car, even though we had just gotten by it. Yeah. It was scary as fucking shit. It's, like, one of my most vivid memories. But there was also, on that same tour, I think it was the same tour, there was a couple funny things. One was when we got a flat tire, and neither of us knew how to change a tire, and we're in the middle of nowhere. So it was like 5 a.m. and we had to, like, walk miles and miles to find an elderly couple who was awake at the time to help out. But there was also, we stopped at a gas station in the middle of nowhere. We're getting gas, and this guy is like, Sage and Soul? He's like an old dude. And he just was a random fan who spotted us in this random ass territory during a time where neither of us were very well known. And I don't know if you remember that, but that always stuck with me too. It was crazy.
I just remember going to all the coffee shop, going to all the bagel stores and being like, do you guys sell bagels? Yeah. And they're like, oh, no, that's how we pronounce it back in the States. Like, oh, God.
It's the little things, Tim. It's the little things.
Yep. It really is. Well, all right, let's go back to politics. So you've long since railed against Democrats and Republicans as pretty much being the same thing. And now we have Donald Trump as president, as our commander in chief, dare I say. So what do you think as you look at all this, as you look at the world and where things are headed?
Well, I look at the Democratic Party as being, obligated to change how they do things. I don't know if they will, but like that is the my feeling. I think it's a growing concern in America and the world where we look at the Democrats like, you guys really don't understand how you fucked this up, and how you're not enough of a difference from the Republicans that, you know, people couldn't rally behind you enough to defeat Trump. That's crazy. I thought that this year would have been the perfect year for a third party to step up and really gain official traction in the overall scheme of things. I don't know what it's going to take now. If it didn't happen now this time, I don't know what the fuck it's going to take next time. So, you know what it might take is if Hillary runs for office again.
I mean, I've heard that there's like all these rumors about Chelsea Clinton running for president.
Fuck all that. that might be what it takes, though, because if a Clinton tries to run for office as a Democrat, that actually might be the thing that kicks the third party like into the stratosphere. Like, nope, fuck all that. Fuck the DNC, and all right, we're going this way. But whatever the fuck. I'm strictly an independent voter, and I will whatever. Like when it comes time for me to decide who I think is best, I will vote for them. But this is just crazy times, and every single day you wonder: are we entering a war, like a world war, or not? Like, or is this like Russian collusion a thing or not? They keep dangling this carrot, and like, what is the distraction? What is the reality? I don't fucking know. Like, I can't keep up with this 24-hour news cycle of dangling carrots. And I just – it's beyond me, honestly. I'm not a political analyst. I'm a fucking regular-ass dude. And I'm fortunate enough to put together words that properly relay my feelings, and it resonates with others. But I can't call it right now.
Yeah, I don't know what to think either. It's like when I turn on the news or I listen to something, it's like, you know, I can kind of only even handle it from like somebody like John Oliver. You know, he's like he's like the only one who I feel like I don't know, it's like makes me laugh.
That's been grinding on me lately too. I can't even listen to that and enjoy it. I'm sick of the jokey takes, and I'm sick of the jokes being like not the jokes. I'm sick of the comedians being the ones who get to relay news. It's like, I don't want to celebrate that. I don't want that to be we fucking went through all that. We went through that with Jon Stewart, and he was a big part of that that period during the Bush years. And then everything kind of like fell apart during the Obama years, and it got less, you know, like less relevant, less funny. And now that like we're under constant threat with Trump, like here come the jokes, you know, like something about it irks me. I don't really fucking dig it. So yeah, I'm not really sure where I stand on all that right now. I do know that I'm less entertained by the satirical news.
Well, that's because it's so, we all know under Obama, drone wars, you know, the perpetual wars didn't, you know.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah.
And they fucking weren't making the jokes, you know, or maybe they were, but just was like, people who now are jumping on the wagon, like, oh man, now we get to this like low hanging fruit. This Trump joke is like low hanging fruit for comedians, and it's just so easy for them to like pop, 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 and people like laugh it away, and like these memes that occupy Facebook feeds that you think you know, you think you know what's happening, and you click like or laugh, LOL, and like that satiates some kind of need in an artificial way. It's some need, something that needs to happen. You satiate that fight in a way that just like a few clicks and okay, I'm good for now. But it actually does nothing. You learned nothing. You changed nothing. You just push that button and get the dopamine shot.
Yeah, and hey, maybe Trump responds to someone, you know, on Twitter, and then like that becomes headline news for the next 3 days while he's,
yeah,
you know, putting another climate denier in charge of, you know, fixing the ocean or something. And it's it's sad.
It's tough to keep up. It's every single day. I mean, we forget about shit that would have been huge news in any other presidency. Just a week later is like a whole new thing to fucking be amazed about and be in shock about. And then you forget, damn, this is like, this is an unending list of stuff that like now this is the new. This might be the new template for every fucked up leader to follow. Like, I didn't know I could get away with all that. I just had to keep doing shitty things. That's cool. Like,
yeah, and that's why Kanye will be the next president, you know?
It's very possible.
Oh man. I guess I don't know. Let me ask you this. Is there somewhere you draw the line between the personal and the political?
Not officially. I've never consciously done that, I don't think. Do you? How do you do that?
Yeah, I don't know. The main thrust of this interview for me is like how, you know, you've gone from being like overtly political to being this more just like general social critic that's also, you know, engaged in work that improves, you know, improves people's quality of life and,
I want to be careful not to act as a mouthpiece for any movement. I am a supporter of several movements and I am a supporter of information. I like people to get the right information when possible, but I'm not the Sean King of any movement. You know, like that dude will like jump on every single issue related to Black America. And that is a position that I think he put himself into, and that's what people expect from him now. And more power to him, but that, like, I don't like those things. I don't want to be that. I don't want to be president. I want to exist in a more, I guess, human manner. I'm a human with different interests, and not all of them people are going to dig, and not all my beliefs people are going to believe in. But as an artist, I like to be able to say things and do things in a way that is entertaining and people can appreciate. And that's what I focus on. As far as the political stuff, I never really, it's weird that you say that I was overtly political, because I don't know if I felt like I was at the time. I kind of was like, if I was pissed off about something, I made the song about it. And the truth of the matter is I said what needed to be said. And for the most part, I still believe all of it, but I can't repeat it. And I don't, you know, like I don't want to harp on any one thing and like make the same song over and over. So right. At a certain point, like how many times can I make the breakup song to the girl? You know, like I need to continue, or how many times can I rail against the president? Like I need to think of interesting and innovative ways to get my beliefs out there and not sound, make it seem like I'm trying to beat a belief system over anyone's head. Because I don't like when people do it to me. I don't like Christian music. You know, I don't like religious music. I don't like when there's I don't like when there's an agenda underneath the art. It's like the art is only existing here so that I can push these ideas on people. Like something about that really turns me off. I feel offended by that and I don't appreciate it. And I don't feel like it improves my quality of life or my enjoyment of life on any level. So I'm careful not to do that. I try not to do that in my music. And I guess I think that's as good of an answer as I can give you for what you asked.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's perfect, man. And well, let me ask you this. What have you done in your personal life to be, you know, to feed the better parts of yourself and to sort of grow, to become a healthier, happier person?
Not a whole hell of a lot, man. not a whole hell of a lot. I'm trying.
Well, how are you not angry anymore? Like, you're not, like, back in the day when I used to know you, you were angry, you know? And like, when I'm around you now, like, you're not angry at all.
Nah. Yeah. I don't, I'm older, I guess. I don't know. I really don't know the answer to that. I think I've just seen so much, I've experienced so much, and I've changed in ways that I can't put my finger on, but not everything is worth spitting fire over. It's kind of like you have to pick your spots, baby. You know,
yeah,
you pick,
right.
Pick your spots. That's something I guess I'm learning. And I grew up an angry person. I do have anger issues and, you know, push the right buttons at the wrong time, bad things happen. That's not like, I try to just be as chill as possible. Again, I've seen a lot. I think it's changed the way that I fucking process the world and how I process each situation. And I've dealt with so much shit from people in business and in my personal life that it's like a threshold had been met and then disintegrated. So, I hope it's a good thing. I hope it's not – I hope it doesn't come across as, oh, he just doesn't care anymore. I just think there's a parallel lifestyle or belief system that has kind of taken over.
And I think that's one of the funny things about the title of your new album being called Copper Gone. Because I feel like, don't you feel like that phrase like implies like there's nothing left here?
Yeah.
But yet that album is like this classic return to form. And I mean,
yeah, I mean, it did the Copper Gone title, I think, touches upon what the socioeconomic situation of a lot of places in America and where I live. I mean, I got the album title from a abandoned house down the street from where I live, and it had been very popular, or copper stripping had been very popular around here because the economy was in the tank and people are just trying to fucking get scrap metal. And I just saw that when Copper Gone was spray painting on a building, it burned in my brain. Something about it, it was like, damn, that is the most passive aggressive graffiti in the world. So something about it did hit a certain part of my psyche, because I had a dream where my grandmother was telling me that she really loved my album Copper Gone, which was before I ever thought of calling my album Copper Gone. So that dream itself kind of
weird.
It made me realize there's something about that title that sticks and means something. There's like the symbolic nature of a house telling the world to leave it the fuck alone because there's nothing left of value in it. Even though it's a shelter, you know, it's like, it's actually a shelter. There is purpose there, but not what you are looking for.
That's awesome. All right. Well, just a couple more questions. So you were talking about moving waveforms around. Have you ever, like, are you making beats now? Are you getting to a point where you're ready to rap on your own beats?
Yeah, I've done that a little bit. And it's been a long time coming. I've wanted to do that my whole life. I had a sampler when I was a kid, but I didn't have, I mean, I had a, like a SP50, an Akai S15, I think, or 50, but it had eight buttons, but it didn't have a sequencer. So I had to manually trigger every sample, and I couldn't figure out how all these beats were getting made by the rappers I liked. And then I worked at Ben and Jerry's to save up for a sampler, and I ended up getting an MPC. And then as soon as I got that, my touring career kicked off, and I kind of like left that behind and never really got into figuring out the machine and how these things work. I'm really not like I'm not technically savvy. I have a difficult time figuring systems out, but once I do, I just become engrossed in it, and I become neurotic, and I need to continually do it. And I know that about myself. So I was like, I'm not going to get into this until I know I have a lot of free time to really go in. And that's been happening over the past few months, where I've started the process, and I'm really enjoying it. I love it. Like, whether the beats end up being how I thought they would be, just the process of, cause I'm doing a very simple, I like the idea of working off of a grid. I don't like, I think that is going to be a signature sound of mine when, and if my production ever appears on an official project, where it's like tempos may change ever so slightly, and not everything is totally synced up and locked up exactly how you expect from a machine. That is in its own way going to bring back an organic feel and more natural how music actually flows and not how a machine plays it, even though it's sample based, because I love sampling music. So, and who the fuck can release sampled music anymore without getting copyright notices and sued? So who the fuck knows how I'm going to do it, all of this shit, but maybe just release some free things from time to time.
Yeah, I mean, just pitch it down, man. You know, there's easy ways.
Yeah, but then there's these fucking websites that snitch on everybody, and, you know, it just, they're violating straight up and down.
Oh, man. Yeah, well, have you ever gotten legal notice on a sample?
Yeah, I have.
Wow.
And I expect that to be more and more common as the years continue, and as a technology gets better, like that, the sound source, or what do you call it? What is it called when? Because when you upload something to like SoundCloud, it automatically detects what song it is and where it comes from. So that technology is just omnipresent on the internet now, and it's already incredible. It's already very good. I just don't like. I don't know how anyone could get away with doing any kind of sampled music, but we'll find our ways. This is outlaw music. This is why I got into hip hop in the first place.
When the first sentient robot comes to consciousness, the first thing it's going to do is go back and like fucking bust us on all of our drum loops and shit.
Yeah.
Oh man. All right. Well, what about Strange Famous Records, man? What you got coming out now? Like, what's coming out over the next few months? What are your plans? What are you excited about?
The big development at Strange Famous was creating the digital subsidiary label SF Digi. Several reasons why we did that. Because I had come across so many artists in my travels and openers who would blow me away with their performance. And then, or I would get demos that I thought were incredible, but I'm like, you know, we're limited as a label as far as releasing physical items to the world, and that would just leave us in debt, and nobody would make money, and it's just would be a dumb enterprise for me to like try to release everything physically. So I came up with the system that I think is pretty much the opposite of a 360 deal, which major labels have kind of employed, and their artists are like paying percentages of all profits throughout their career on all aspects of their career, which I think is crazy. But these major labels have become the gatekeepers for mainstream recognition. So I guess if you want to play the game like that, that's what you have to give up. But on an independent level, or not, on a more like indie or underground level, I think our move is to allow artists to keep all the money that they make on physical sales at shows, and just put the impetus on them to create their own physical product while we promote and sell digital through all digital media. And there's a give and take there, but it's like the way it's all playing out, it's kind of perfect for now. And I think this is going to stick, and I might even focus more on this than actual Strange Famous Records official releases, because a lot of the same work goes into it, but it's just a lot less money is spent overall. And then in due time, artists see more money from their efforts. I don't really think you want to get into the crunching numbers here, but it's, you know, people are getting their promotion online, you know, just like anything else. And they're accessing the music online just as they would with everyone else. The only difference is we're not pandering to publicists. We're not paying for any big promotion services. We're not paying like tons of money for vinyl and CDs and tapes. We are doing some physical product, but people have to come to us directly for it. And I love making artists feel like they should be involved in putting together their own product when they tour, and give them a reason to tour, because that is really where you're going to make most of your money.
Right. I thought that, I mean, when I saw that that you're doing the 7 inches and just that whole model, I thought that was just brilliant and such a great way to cut out the bullshit.
And shout out to Storm Davis, who, I mean, he's been with me through all of this and all these changes and coming up with these ideas that help bring them to life. Because he's the one who came up with the idea of doing a 7-inch for every release on SF Digi. And that being like a very limited release and just a special thing for every project, and not just wiping our hands totally free, like, okay, we'll just release it digitally, because that's easy. You know, like anyone, like I said before, can upload their album to TuneCore and pay an annual fee for it to be available worldwide on digital channels. But as a label and as a, I don't know, as a entity and a group collective who has garnered a loyal fan base and people who are interested in what we do, they know to come to us for the special items and stuff if they want the physical stuff. And we also sell the digital stuff on our own website, which I would prefer people use, but I understand that, you know, iTunes or Bandcamp have become more of a normal go-to for the general buying public. But yeah, that's what we've been doing with Strange Famous, picking up more artists, being able to work with more artists due to the fact that expenses are lower when focusing more on digital rather than physical.
And being able to help break artists, because nobody's doing that anymore.
I know that I want to help develop careers. I want to help break artists. And some artists don't even want to be broken. So, you know, some artists don't care to go that extra step or have their recognition level raised all that much. They kind of – that's a weird thing that I've noticed in our world, but it's there. And I'll hear music from some people who I think the music's so good – they are so talented, but they have zero interest in touring. They have zero interest in doing shows. They have zero interest in online promoting the way you need to do if you actually expect record sales. But fuck it. Like, I can still put out the music. I can still make our fans aware that this artist exists and that this music is great. And with no expectations of it blowing up, you know, like that is a wonderful position for me to be in, and for a system for us to have. So yeah,
that way you're not stressing out. Like, oh my god, I just dumped $5,000 into this shit, and I
got
500 records returned.
Yeah, we still go through that, but I love the idea of just growing our roster and talent level and activity. because we have the staff, you know, we have these channels, we have the online channels, like, let's utilize them. Let's get more interesting material out to the public and let artists feel like they, you know, if they want to climb up and get more recognition and get more sales, they have that opportunity, but it's going to take work. You know, like, you have to fucking dig in a little bit, or a lot of bit. So other than that, we're planning on releasing. I mean, we just put out the Dope Knife album, which I'm really into. We just put out the Cass One Verse Figure album, which is pretty crazy.
I love those guys, man.
Yeah, they're cool. They're on tour. They're doing the Four Horsemen tour with B. Dolan and DJ Abilities and Dope Knife. So I think they got about 8 more shows left. But yeah, they've been grinding it out. That's been a hell of a fucking tour. Cecil Otter, we're still working with. I know his follow-up album is like 8 years in the making, but we're still working with him on it, and I expect that to come out next year. But the big thing that I'm focusing on is the Epic Beardmen album. B. Dolan and I have been collaborating on this project for over 2 years now, and to get us in the same room and record and write together, it's like neither of us are familiar with that process. It's not easy for us to do that, but we're also very like perfectionist as far as how we want things to sound, and to come to agreements on how all that will work out is kind of, I think, what's prolonging this whole thing. But by the time the shit drops, because we got about 17 demos done, I'm real like excited, and it's fun music, but there's also some hard hitting like social shit happening in the like socially conscious shit that just rears its ugly head from time to time, but it deserves to be there. And by next year, we'll have that album out and we'll be touring nonstop. So I'm enjoying my time home in the meantime.
That's awesome. Yeah. I know I have, but every time I'm like writing in a room with another rapper, I'm like, what year is it right now?
The only time I had done that, I mean, the first time I did that, it was with you. Honestly, like that, I'm such a, I write on my own. I was an only child. I lived alone. It's just like when we went up to Maine and we sat in a room to write a song together, it was like, that is weird. It's like, that's just not a normal, as a writer who's like, it's a very internal personal thing. And then here we are sitting together. It was like a writing orgy. It's fucking bizarre. But
yeah, it's intensely personal for me these days, you know. Last one I did was with Chesky, I think.
Actually just saw him the other day. He's been having a fucking rough year, so just a lot of bullshit falling onto his plate, and it's not cool because he's definitely one of the nicest fucking cats in the world. So shout out to Chesky.
Fucking love Chesky, man.
Yeah.
I guess that wraps up this shit. I like to ask people what books they recommend, or what they're geeking out on, you know, on the reading tip. You know, what's your favorite book, or is there anything you'd recommend? Anything you've been reading lately that you've been enjoying?
I'm a slow reader, but I geeked out over Tom Robbins. Tom Robbins, definitely one of my favorite writers ever. And once I discovered him, a fan threw his book at me at a California show, and I read it. And then I bought his entire fucking catalog. I also bought triples of his catalog so I could give away to people.
Nice.
I fucking love, like, if I fucking geek out over something, it's like, I'm all in. So once I devoured his catalog, I started going back to, Kurt Vonnegut, who I really enjoy. But my favorite book that I've ever read was Confederacy of Dunces. I don't know if you've read that, but no. that book had me like laughing out loud every other page. No other book has done that. I was fucking like sad. Like, I was depressed when the book was over, when I finished it. But the writer, Douglas, what's his name? That's stupid. I can't remember his name right now. But it was the only book he had written. He died before it even came out. He thought it was a failure. He had killed himself. But his mom found the manuscript and brought it to a professor, and then it just became one of the best-selling books of all time. It's really a fascinating fucking book, funny as shit. But yeah, that's my favorite book in the past 10 years. And other than that, I mean, books are the one thing – it used to, yeah, books are the one thing outside of music and business that I can enjoy and I feel like it's taken an actual break from regular life, and I cherish it. I cherish those moments.
That's great. Okay, well, yeah, well, you know what's funny about Tom Robbins is, like, when we were trying to name our kid, I kept saying I wanted to name him Billy Baghdad, and Yasmin was like, dude – like, that sounds like a Tom Robbins character. Like, you can't name him Billy Baghdad. I was like, I know, I just want him to sound like he's a Wild Western outlaw or something. all right, well, if people want to check you out, how can they follow you online and all that shit?
You can get me at Twitter, Sage Francis, at Facebook, Sage Francis, at Instagram, Sage Francis. SFR. Oh. Sage Francis SFR on Instagram. Mark it down.
Awesome. Hey, man, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Lovely to talk to you, Timmy.
Yeah, have a great day and enjoy the beautiful weather.
Tell Yasmin I said what up. Give your kid a kiss on the forehead for me.
All right, I'll tell him the Sage says what up.
Appreciate it.
All right, homie. Peace out, man.
Bye. Love you.
Later.
They want to corrupt me, they try to corrupt me. This ain't no swan song, this is for the ugly ducklings of my country. Game dummy, you can't keep the reins from me. It's us who put in the overtime, they who make the money. Snickering at trickle down economy. We got nickeled and dimed, it's more like highway robbery. Driving the fast lane, eyes on the gas gauge. Listen to neocons cry about black rage. It doesn't stop there, they're the blowhards. They puff out their chest, they're full of hot air. Providing entertainment for the status quo. Then once every 4 years they pander to the black vote. Oh, religion ain't a tool of control. Why they pull the guard card once they're losing in the polls? Foolish, I know, we're victims of circumstance. It ain't coincidence with children of the worker ants. And those in power ain't never owned a pair of dirty pants. But they're quick to kill your health insurance plans. The rich cheat death with their cheap survival. They found more than one way to beat the Bible. Street disciple, my beat's a trifle mega. Don't repeat the cycle, just live your life better. I'ma defeat my rival, that's why I'm writing this letter. To let them know that we ain't giving up the fight ever. Ever, 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 ever. They wanna corrupt me, they try to corrupt me. This ain't no swan song, this is for the ugly ducklings of my country.
You are not alone in it.
Oh yeah, I got a weapon of mass destruction parked in the back. It's a vessel of gas consumption. Rebels of rap production never adapted to nothing. Imagine my laugh whenever you ask me for something. Like I ain't gave my all. You came fashionably late to the headbanger's ball. After the mob scene lost steam, and after we spilled pig's blood on the prom queen. I've been told with old age comes wisdom, but I found with old age comes old age. We're stuck in our old ways like everything was done much better in some forgotten era. Thumb stuck in America. I can't begin to name the ways I pin the blame on an administration acting inhumane. If it's killing season, start within. When the hunter becomes the hunted, they outlaw hunting. Confiscate the ammunition, cause there's a wolf in sheepskin, a pit bull with lipstick, a pig in a blanket, some lame duck president. Privatizing profit and socializing debt. Collapse credit, journalists get arrested. Watch the Blackwater operatives go domestic. Oh, that's a problem, we'll tone agonize. Smoke them if you got them, a whole pack of lies. Summer, spring, and autumn, now bring the winter time. I don't protest the snow, I shovel it with picket signs.
Picket signs, picket signs, picket signs.
Wanna corrupt me, they try to corrupt me. This ain't no swan song, this is for the ugly ducklings of my country. We have the right to assembly, the duty of the patriot to protect his country from the government. But when we try it, but when we try it, but when we try it, peace rally with my friends. Conspiracy to riot. When we have no defense. Conspiracy to riot. Rubber bullets to the heads. Conspiracy to riot. finally pull the cord.
Conspiracy to riot, conspiracy to riot, conspiracy to riot.
As the truth is revealed,
conspiracy to riot.
We ain't choosing to kneel,
conspiracy to riot.
Let me be the human shield,
conspiracy to riot.